Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, political consultant Liz Smith talks about why an early Michigan primary is important, even if a President Biden renomination appears to be a fait accompli. Senator Jeff Irwin talks about his no vote on the Goshen plant near Big Rapids, Line 5, his new nursing bills, and other issues. And Green Township Supervisor Jim Chapman talks about some of the crazier rumors that have sprouted as his divided community debated the Goshen plant. What can stop the plant at this point, if it can be stopped? Here's host Kyle Malin and Samantha Schreiber.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. President Biden is expected to release a video tomorrow. We're taping on Monday, so it'll be Tuesday, declaring his intention to run for re-election in 2024. This comes as noted progressive author Marianne Williamson comes to Michigan State University to talk about her second bid for the presidency, and Robert F. Kennedy filing earlier this month his run for the nation's chief executive post. Joining us to talk about this and other political issues is political strategist Liz Smith, who knows a little about running for president, having been a senior advisor for then-Mayor Pete Buttigieg's presidential run and being part of Barack Obama's 2012 campaign. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Liz Smith.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So as we're taking a look at President Biden and this, I guess, quote-unquote soft launch, why is it that we still have to ask President Biden, are you really going to run for president? Are you really going to do this? Because it seems like that's still the question we're asking.
Yeah, look, I think no one will be more relieved by, you know, 8 or 9 a.m. tomorrow, whenever they release the video, than President Biden, because you can tell that these questions have started to get under his skin. And I think why you have these questions asked of him more so than you have had of previous presidents is because of the age factor. And the president and his advisors are aware of that. You know, he's someone who will be 82 on election day, and you know that's older than any previous president running for re-election. But I suspect that the second he puts his video out, he will put all of those questions to bed.
Do you think we're going to continue to have these folks who are going to be challenging him, Kennedy, Williamson? Will there be more of this, or will there be less attention on these second tier candidates?
Well, I think that those two will certainly challenge him. They're in the race now. I don't really see the field getting much bigger than that. And one thing that's been fairly impressive and a very good sign for Joe Biden is that he has been able to coalesce, you know, the full party behind him. You know, you've seen progressive members of Congress like Pramila Jayapal and AOC endorsing him and praising some of his accomplishments. So I don't suspect any, you know, vigorous challenge to him. But yes, we will see challenges from RFK Jr. and Marianne Williamson.
So for 2024, when he launches the video tomorrow, what do you think needs to be in that video?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's going to be about what the stakes of the election are, how far he's been able to bring us during the first couple years of his presidency. You know, we were dealing with an unprecedented global pandemic, and he was able to take that on to give direct relief to the American people, but also make important long-term investments in our infrastructure, do something that presidents have talked about for decades and not been able to get done, which is to allow Medicare to negotiate for lower drug prices. He's been able to make a historic climate investments. So I think it's important for him to talk about the things that he's been able to get done, things that people will actually be able to start feeling now before the 2024 election, and to also talk about what's at stake and why we can't hand our country over to the Republican Party, the current Republican Party, and all the progress that they will be able to undo. And I think that that is really going to be one of the best things for him in this election. Not necessarily all the things that he has been able to accomplish, but the contrast that he will have, and which is that he's up against a Republican Party that is perceived as far outside the mainstream, and a Republican Party that is seen as wanting to undo a lot of the progress that he's made during his tenure as president.
An NBC News poll released Sunday found just 26% of Americans think Biden should run for a second term, and 70% say he should not. How do you run for re-election against that kind of headwind?
Well, look, I know that he's been seeing all these polls, and you've even seen polls with 50% of Democrats saying that they don't, they would prefer someone else other than Joe Biden to run. But it's all noise. He's going to run. He's going to be the nominee. And I think what these polls speak to more than anything is people's general disaffection with the political atmosphere. You know, we live in a hyper-polarized time where I think people are rightly tired of politics and the political system. But one thing that we've seen about him versus his predecessor, President Trump, is that, you know, in the midterms, voters were not motivated to vote against Joe Biden in the same way that in 2018, voters were motivated to vote against Donald Trump. So there isn't a strong animus toward Joe Biden, and certainly not nowhere near as strong as there was toward Donald Trump. But it will be incumbent upon Joe Biden to communicate to the American people what he's been able to do as president and what he will continue to do if he's reelected. And that's one way that he will be able to excite them and get them to turn out to vote for him and make sure that we don't hand the keys to the White House over to the Republican Party.
You know, I do want to make a transition to another branch of government and look at the U.S. Senate race in Michigan that everyone's gearing up for. And I think there was a bit of excitement when Debbie Stabenow announced that she was retiring, that this would pass the baton over to a very competitive, very colorful Democratic primary of these young up-and-coming leaders. However, instead, you kind of see, as opposed to a competitive, colorful primary, you see a kind of paving the way for Alyssa Slotkin. Does this dilute democracy?
No, I don't think it dilutes democracy. If anything, it's a recognition of what a strong candidate Alyssa is. And, you know, there are plenty of races that people can run for. And, you know, as you guys know, I do some work for Mallory McMorrow, who decided not to run for U.S. Senate this cycle. And what she said when she decided not to run is that we need to stop treating federal offices like they're the only thing that matter, that higher office is the only thing that matters. And the amazing thing about Michigan is it has this impressive, impressive bench of Democratic elected officials. You have an amazing governor, amazing lieutenant governor, amazing secretary of state, amazing attorney general, amazing, you know, state level elected officials like Mallory McMorrow. You have an amazing congressional delegation. And I think more important than having this big, vibrant primary is celebrating the fact that you have accomplished vibrant next generation Democrats at every level of government. And if anything, Michigan stands as an example for the rest of the country in terms of the type of Democratic bench that you should build up. And it speaks to how well the members of you know, every level of government work together, that there isn't this big contentious primary. And, you know, there's no question that the Michigan Senate race is going to be one of the top races of 2024. So it's probably in the best interest of the Democratic Party to avoid a big, messy primary.
So we shouldn't read too much into the fact that it looks like it's going to be Alyssa Slotkin's race. And there doesn't seem to be anybody coming up except maybe Hill Harper, if he ends up getting into this or not.
No, if anything, it would speak to Alyssa's strength. You know, she's someone who's been able to win in a very battleground congressional seat the last few cycles and been able to raise the resources that you would need to run a competitive Senate race. And she's someone who has been recognized as one of the, you know, brightest, youngest, next generation stars in the Democratic Party. And so if anything, I think that it's someone we should celebrate. And it speaks to the strength and of the Michigan Democratic Party, but also how much Democrats here have their stuff together, that it's not devolving into sort of a Lord of the Flies situation when it comes to the U.S. Senate race.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about the early primary states. I know that the DNC wanted to essentially create a system where, you know, states are reoccurringly bidding to become an early primary state. Do you think Michigan is still going to carry this slot when it comes to not the upcoming presidential election, but the next one?
Look, that remains to be seen. Right now, the DNC is saying that every 4 years, every state has an equal opportunity to get to the front of the line in the primaries. And so it's very possible that Michigan could play a prominent role in 2028. And I think that the fact that they do have an early seat in 2024 will serve as an advantage to them. And that's good for Michigan, yes, because it will bring more attention to Michigan issues, bring more attention to Michigan's economy, certainly more money to Michigan's economy, because you will have, you know, probably both a vibrant Democratic and Republican field spending money in Michigan. But it's also good for the country because Michigan is the ultimate battleground state, and it's very diverse in terms of the voters that you have to reach out to, diverse racially, ethnically, religiously, economically. And so that will force candidates to figure out what their messages are for different audiences and how to appeal to voters of all stripes. And I think it's really, really important that we do have an early primary from, you know, the Midwest. The Democrat, Debbie Dingell has done a really good job. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell has done a really good job of highlighting how the Democratic Party can sometimes be a little coastal heavy. When she was running for congressional leadership, she pointed out how all of the congressional leadership in the Democratic Party came from, you know, either both of the coasts. And when the Democratic Party decided to get rid of Iowa as the first state, there was concern that we would sort of be putting the Midwest aside. So it is really important for Michigan to be in there, for us to have a strong Midwestern voice in there. And because of Michigan's centrality to American politics, and especially to American presidential politics, I suspect that it will continue to have a strong early role in the presidential selection process.
So, but talking about this year, this or this next cycle, 2024, as we go toward that, is it going to be, is all that energy that Michigan put toward being an early primary state, is it going to end up kind of being a fizzle nothing burger just because Biden's supposed to win this thing in a walk? So what difference does it make if we're fourth or fifth or fifth or 50th?
Right. Well, I think it's good preparation for 2028, and you will have a little bit of a primary in 2024. I mean, the reality is that Joe Biden is largely ignoring the fact that he's got two challengers right now. He didn't put out a statement when either Marianne Williamson or RFK Jr. announced, and I don't suspect you will see a ton of Joe Biden in early states like Michigan, but it's good preparation. And it's really fun being an early primary state. You know, in 2020, I spent a ton of time with Pete in states like Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and it's an amazing opportunity for states and local Democratic parties to really spotlight, you know, everything they've got going on. And it's really great for local businesses. You know, you see these local restaurants that are super colorful and recognized by locals as, you know, being amazing, delicious, whatever, sort of taking on, becoming sort of national icons. And that's really fun to see. And I think it gives, you know, people of these states a lot of pride. And so I'd love to see that happen for Michigan. I mean, Michigan is a big state, and it really spans in terms of geography and cultures there. And it'd be amazing to see it getting that sort of recognition and, you know, seeing candidates photographed all over the state. So, this is a good dry run, I think, for maybe a more competitive primary. And that's really important. We certainly saw that in 2020 when Iowa was unable to actually carry out their duties as the first primary state when they messed up their voting. So it's good for any state, I think, to get a little practice at this before it's really thrown into a full throttle early state primary.
I think a big story in Michigan is a lot of like, oh, will Governor Whitmer run for president in 2028? And as someone who's worked with, you know, Barack Obama, Pete Buttigieg, at what point do you notice like, hey, I think that they might be, you know, gearing toward that next or preparing for the next job they want to run for?
Yeah, it's when you can see them start looking past what they're doing in their state, really, to, you know, maybe being in on more national TV shows, you know, maybe placing op-eds more in the New York Times, Washington Post. That's an obvious tell. Or any time that they are sort of tying what they're doing in the state to national issues. Now, some of this stuff you're naturally going to do, right? I think it's really, really important, especially right now when Washington is divided, for Democrats in Michigan to point to everything that they're doing to say, hey, this is what happens if you elect Democrats. But yeah, I mean, politics isn't that complicated. And generally, you can tell when people have higher ambitions. And that's oftentimes when they start looking beyond the borders of their state. And that involves travel. You know, if they start popping up in other early states or start popping up at White House Correspondents' Dinner and on Meet the Press, that's usually a tell. But I think no matter what Governor Whitmer decides, it's really, really important for her to have a national platform, both to tell the story of Michigan, but also because we do need more sort of women executives stepping up and providing that example in American politics. And in both of those senses, she is a tremendous, tremendous advocate and tremendous voice for the Democratic Party.
So you could see her running for president.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I talk with a lot of Democrats, a lot of Democratic donors, a lot of people in the media, and there is a lot of interest in Governor Whitmer. She's done a tremendous job as governor, you know, first with a very divided government and now with a blue trifecta where they're basically, you know, running the table in terms of accomplishments and really serving as a model for the rest of the nation, you know, being able to repeal the 1931 abortion ban, implement these really critical gun safety measures, update the Elliot Larson, the civil rights law to protect more LGBTQ Michiganders, to provide middle class tax relief to people. It's a record that anyone would be envious of. And, you know, she's a great communicator and she comes across as very likable, very relatable on TV. And I think that that is something that, you know, paired with her accomplishments would make her a very formidable candidate for governor, for president.
Yeah, I do want to take a step back to the Alyssa Slotkin conversation we were having. You know, I think Alyssa Slotkin is the type of candidate who is, you know, she has kind of run off of being a moderate. You know, she's like, you know, I want common sense gun control and I want to keep our children safe, but I also own a Glock. You know, she's like, I represent women who might vote for Trump, but they also want a right to an abortion. And that makes me ask, will 2024 be the year of the moderate Democrat?
Look, I'm someone who can be a little allergic to these titles sometimes because I think they are more divisive than they need to be. I think of Alyssa more as a reasonable, common sense Democrat. I think she is someone who really is where the mainstream of the Democratic Party is. There are voices in the Democratic Party who get outsized attention, but I think who are way to the left of even where the mainstream of the Democratic Party is. I don't think that's the case for Alyssa. The reality here as well is that she has a different type of background. She has a national security background, and she's been representing a more conservative district, a district where you know, they were not going to elect a Democratic socialist to Congress. And I think what's important as a Democratic Party is that we have elected officials, that we have candidates who appeal to the broadest sort of swath of the American voter. And that's the only way that we're going to be able to build anything close to a near permanent majority. And Alyssa Slotkin, to me, is indicative of the sort of Democrats that we need to recruit. She does have an interesting public service background. She is a woman. She is younger than, way younger than sort of your average member of Congress or of the U.S. Senate. And she's someone who is perceived by voters as independent. And we need to be able to put up candidates who are able not just to appeal to Democrats, but to sort of pierce the partisan bubble and appeal to independents and Republicans who are willing to listen. And in that sense, I think she's a fantastic candidate. And that if we could sort of clone her and have, you know, 50 or 100 Alyssa Slotkins running for U.S. Senate across the country, the Democratic Party would probably be in a stronger position.
Liz Smith, she is a political strategist affiliated with the Democratic Party. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Great. Thank you for having me. So you can see what's going on.
Joining us now on the podcast is the state senator out of Ann Arbor. He is Jeff Irwin. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You were one of the no votes on the Goshen project and allocating state money to that Goshen project. I wanted to start with that before we get into other subjects. You have been consistently against what you would call corporate welfare. Was there any chance that you were going to support this?
Well, look, I think that you're right in pointing out that over the years I've expressed that, you know, my philosophy on economic development is that Michigan is in a race for talent. And the most important things we can do to ensure the future prosperity of our state is invest in education, invest in housing that is affordable, invest in things like public transit, which is a real missing link in Southeast Michigan. And so, you know, those are the things I think are most important. And every time an economic development proposal that is based on, you know, providing direct incentives to companies come forward, you know, I try to, you know, look at that and analyze it very specifically, because even though I have that philosophy, even though that's my way of looking at these things, I try to use that philosophy and ideology as more of a lens than a filter. And so, no, I haven't opposed every economic development proposal that's come forward based on incentives. And to get a little bit deeper into the specifics of what's happening right now, you know, I feel like I should, you know, just say I give the governor a lot of credit, because, you know, she's been able to persuade me to vote for 2 out of 3 of the more recent battery plant incentives. And I think she's made a really strong pitch that we want to build the cars of the future here in Michigan. I agree with her on that. And that we're at a real inflection moment in the automobile industry in this changeover to EVs. And so there are very high stakes with the locations of these battery plants. And so, you know, that has what's really gotten me into the game. That's what's gotten me to the table to say, okay, let's look at each of these investments. Let's analyze them and let's try to make good decisions. They're going to be good for the future of Michigan in light of the really strong argument that the governor's made about the criticality of this moment as we transition to more and more EVs being built.
But you voted no because...
Yeah. So, you know, I was kind of setting the stage, because I think it's important to mention that I did vote yes on the project in Van Buren Township, the RNX Energy project. I voted yes on the Marshall project that's involved with Ford. But when this Goshen project came up for a vote, when the vote was taken, I hadn't been persuaded. And so I voted no. And the reason why I voted no in a nutshell is the pay and benefits that were being offered by the company didn't seem like the kinds of pay and benefits that were going to lead to a thriving wage for the families that worked there and the people who worked there. They didn't have a particularly impressive package. They also didn't talk about some of the wraparound services that employees might need that some of these other companies do provide, like childcare. And, you know, also when they were asked questions about their willingness to work with organized labor, so that those workers would have a voice in their future pay and benefits, a greater voice in their future pay and benefits, they didn't have good answers about that. And, you know, it weighed on me that the legislators from that area were just so against, you know, bringing those jobs in that facility in the way that it was proposed. You know, finally, I'll mention that, you know, I do have some environmental concerns. I don't want to get too over my skis in trying to understand all the technical aspects of battery technology and where the market is going. But it seemed to me that this plant was going to rely on lithium that was sourced in ways that were not as local to North America, and we're going to probably lead to more destructive practices around the world. And so, you know, for all those reasons, I thought this project was distinct from some of the others that we've voted on.
One more here before we change subjects. Do you see more of these types of economic development, SOAR fund projects coming down the pipe? I'm getting a sense, particularly from the House, that maybe the Democrats over there are getting a little fatigue from all of this money going toward corporations.
Well, I can't speak for all of my colleagues, but I can say that not only are we at a historic moment in the inflection of the auto industry, but, you know, we had a historic opportunity with a budget surplus to really invest in some of these things that have been long-term needs for our state. I mean, I already talked about education and housing and, you know, public transit, you know, fixing our roads. We have a mental health system that is in shambles and has been in shambles since the Engler era. And so for those of us who care about those items, and I'm not suggesting that others who are proposing this don't care, but for those of us who are really focused on those items, you know, it feels like, you know, let's move forward in tandem on these types of investments so that, you know, if we are incentivizing companies, literally paying them to bring jobs here, that we're also increasing our investment in these day-to-day needs that serve the people who are here now and will be here in the future.
So I do have another Goshen related question, but I want to ask it differently. You know, when you hear some of the opponents to that project bring up concerns of national security, do you listen to those concerns or do you write them off as McCarthyism?
Well, I listen to them to see if those concerns are ever expressed in a specific way. But in listening to those concerns, what I've heard generally is just vague accusations. And it comes off to me as xenophobic. It comes off to me as if people are trying to play off of anti-Asian sentiment that is existing in the populace and use that for their political benefit. So frankly, I find that kind of xenophobia disgusting. I think that when Governor Snyder, the previous governor, was trying to build bridges with people in China to do more business, I thought that was appropriate then. And I think it's appropriate that Governor Whitmer does what she's doing, which is, you know, work with people all around the world to try to bring jobs and economic development to our state and to build more bridges, because that's what ultimately is going to not just contribute to Michigan's future prosperity, but it also contributes to peace on earth. All of this saber rattling, all of this xenophobia and bigotry that we hear, you know, from people saying that, you know, China is evil and full of evil people, is just I find it disgusting, frankly. And so, you know, are there things that you know, we can credibly accuse the Chinese government of doing that are horrible? Yes, absolutely. But to lump the entire nation together in that, it just comes off to me as just anti-Asian and playing off of stereotypes. And so I found that frustrating to hear in our capital. And, you know, look, there are going to be some people out there in the public who say those kinds of things. There's going to be your, you know, folks who get on right-wing talk radio and say all sorts of things that are horrible. But when, you know, the chair of the Republican Party is saying things that are horrible like that, it just shows you how far the Republican Party has fallen into a cesspool.
So I think also if we could just dive a little bit into some of the biggest packages that have been approved already. I think obviously sending the red flag legislation to the governor's desk is a big one. Is there anything else that you personally would want to explore in terms of firearm reform legislation?
Yeah, and I think there are a number of proposals out there, a couple that I'll mention. One that other folks I know are working on is, you know, we need to do a better job of keeping firearms out of the hands of domestic abusers and trying to reduce all of the intimate partner violence that is happening across our state. And so I think that's important work. I also think that I'd like to see some of the legislation I've introduced on trying to allow our local governments to keep guns out of public hearings and, you know, township board meetings and city council chambers and those kinds of places, you know, if they see fit. You know, I think that if, you know, they have security concerns within their chambers and they want to make sure that not just the people serving, but also the public who wants to come and talk about important issues in the community, if they want to make sure that those people feel like they're in a safe environment, I think they should have the right to do that, just like the kind of controls we have in our courts right now. And so, you know, if it's appropriate in our courts, I think it should be appropriate in council chambers. And so I've introduced legislation to amend the law to allow our local governments to, you know, have a security plan that they can follow through on for their public hearings.
On another subject, you just recently introduced a bill that removes the state mandate for nurse practitioners in contract with a supervising physician. That's just on its face. It seems a little strange. So wouldn't you want the nurse and the doctor kind of working together for a patient?
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you brought this up, because this is a really important issue. And it's one of those ones that, because it deals with the regulation of healthcare, it is not always easy to communicate with people. So look, we've got problems with healthcare access all around our state. Sometimes those problems are particularly acute in underserved urban areas or in rural areas. But even in areas that don't have an acute shortage of healthcare workers, you still have people encountering long wait times. And, you know, residents shouldn't have to wait, you know, months to get appointments. And we have a group of professionals here in the state of Michigan, nurse practitioners, who I think could do a lot to fill some of those holes. And when you look around the country, Michigan really stands as an outlier. In most states, nurse practitioners and their training and their ability to safely perform procedures is respected by the law in those states, and they're allowed to practice without having a contract with a supervising physician. And so what that means is that when we're trying to attract and retain nurse practitioners here in our state, it becomes very, very difficult. If we're trying to attract an NP from another state, we have to get them to say, yeah, I'm going to leave this state that respects my training and expertise and allows me to practice independently and come to a state that doesn't. And when we're graduating excellent nurse practitioners out of our institutions, we have to somehow encourage them to justify staying in a state that doesn't respect their ability to be able to do this work independently. And so years ago, you know, this issue was brought to my table, my desk, when I was a state representative. And so I have a lot of nurses and I have a lot of doctors in my area. Washtenaw County has some excellent healthcare institutions. And so, you know, I made it my business to try to look into this issue. And the most important thing that I found is that all across the state of Michigan, nurse practitioners are already practicing independently in every way that matters to patients. In most settings, nurse practitioners are the ones who see the patients. They're the ones who assess the problems. They're the ones that diagnose and produce a course of treatment for those patients. And then somewhere else, there's a doctor who has to sign off on that. And oftentimes that doctor never sees the patient and is never even in the building where this patient has come in. And so in cases like that, I started to scratch my head and say, is it really bona fide supervision? Is that supervision really providing value to the patient? Or is it just a box checking exercise that is costing patients and making it harder for us to attract and retain healthcare workers? And obviously I determined that in most cases, it's the latter. And in the cases where doctors and NPs are really working shoulder to shoulder and really are a true team, I think it's going to continue to be that way in those places, you know, in some of our bigger hospitals where that's really the approach. I think that they're going to continue to employ that approach going forward, even if this law changes. So, you know, if we do change this, I don't think the patient experience is going to change a whole lot, except for hopefully we will solve some of this healthcare worker crisis and some of this access problem that many residents face.
Have you heard any numbers from healthcare workers in your district about how much these contracts cost?
You know, I have, I don't have them right at top of mind at this point, but, you know, I believe at our press conference this week, there was a little bit of talk about that, and I'm just not remembering exactly, so I'm reluctant to take a guess at it, but, you know, the point that I guess this gives me an opportunity to stomp my feet on is that we heard from a number of nurse practitioners who basically said, I think it's really troubling that I have to pay someone else in order to be able to do my job. In order for me to be able to do my work up into and including the things I've been trained to do, I have to pay somebody else offsite. And that takes money out of, you know, my pocket, out of my patient's pocket, and it doesn't really provide value.
I notice as I'm looking behind you here at your home office that you have a map of Line 5 behind you. And I just, as a fellow map geek, I kind of think that's pretty cool. But why, and do you agree with the approaches that have been taken to try and prevent the digging of that tunnel?
So I'm also a map geek. I just really like maps and have always tried to collect them in places I go. And, you know, one of the places that I've been is in 2015, I believe, if I remember correctly, we held our first press conference to call for the shutdown of Line 5. At that point, it was in the straits longer than its anticipated lifetime. And there were a number of problems that we were finding with the anchoring and with the lining and with denting on the pipeline. And it seemed like, look, this pipeline is at its retirement age. Let's get it out of there. And so it's frustrating that 7-8 years later now, that pipeline is still in there and it's still operating in a place where there shouldn't be a pipeline. You know, Michigan was used as a shortcut by Enbridge to get hydrocarbons from Canada to Sarnia, which is also in Canada, and they're using the Great Lakes and they're using the Straits of Mackinac as a shortcut. And so I've always thought, look, we need a new plan for getting Enbridge's oil where they want it. And that plan shouldn't include a pipeline in a place where if there's a spill, all the experts have said there's no way to put that genie back in the bottle and it's going to destroy a ton of Great Lakes shoreline, and it's going to be a problem for decades and decades and decades to come, generations to come. So we can't let that happen.
Well, what's wrong with the tunnel? Well, building it under bedrock. If they're building the tunnel right under the earth, I mean, it's not going to spill upward.
I believe that the tunnel is in part a delay tactic by Enbridge to try to bridge the use of their pipeline as long as they can. And I'm not a believer that the tunnel is going to ever happen. The tunnel is, you know, such an expensive and high risk option that, you know, I don't see it getting built, but maybe it will. Even if it does, I think it's important to mention that Line 5 has spilled well over 1 million gallons of oil in Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula, along its length there where it comes by the Cut River and US 2. And so, and we talk a lot about the high risk situation with the pipeline in the Straits, but we know from the last decades that this pipeline is leaking and does leak regularly into these wetlands that drain right into Lake Michigan. And I the value that our state is getting from this pipeline is extremely minimal. I think that the smart approach going forward would be to start converting homes over as quickly as possible to heat pumps, heat exchangers, and do so aggressively. We could save Michigan residents lots of money. We could put a whole lot more people to work in our state, building long-term improvements that save more money than they cost. And there's no reason for us not to do that and to start doing that yesterday. But we continue to fight about Line 5. We continue to shackle our citizens to oil and gas, which, you know, I think is a long-term mistake, not just for our environment, but also economically. We need to close the economic loop. We need to invest in Michigan people, and we need to stop relying upon sources of energy that necessarily come from outside of our borders.
So I think at least in my time of reporting on the state Senate, you've always been the type of senator who wasn't afraid to vote on things in a different direction than your party. Do you feel that having a tight majority, a majority that's defined by 2 seats in the chamber, has that changed the way you go about things as a lawmaker?
Primarily, no. I try to do my best to look at individual issues and try to do what I think is right for the future of the state of Michigan and for my district. What has changed is that the people driving the bus, the people who are deciding what it is we vote on a daily basis, are people who I have a mountain of respect for and who are making better decisions about what gets put on the agenda. And so I think that changes the conversation. You know, that changes the likelihood that some of the suggestions that I'm making about how something could be tweaked one way or another will be listened to. I think it changes the way that things are negotiated. And so, things are changed. The majority's changed. The whole discussion in Lansing is different. And we have a Democratic governor who I respect in agreement and in disagreement. So, you know, all that is very different than when I came into the legislature in 2011. But I still try to hold on to, you know, my independence and my own sense of what's right. And, I think you saw that with the vote on Wednesday with the economic development, initiatives.
All right. Senator Jeff Irwin, Democrat from Ann Arbor. Appreciate you taking some time here and being on the MERS podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Joining us now for the podcast is Jim Chapman. He is the supervisor in Green Township over in Mecosta County near Big Rapids. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for the invitation.
Let's give our listeners here a little background on you. You've been the supervisor there in Green Township for what, 5 years?
5 or 6, right in that area, yeah.
Yeah. How did you get involved in local politics?
Well, myself directly, I got volunteered to fill in on a commission and fill in on a open slot on the board of trustees. But my father was a township supervisor. My grandfather was a township supervisor in different townships. So kind of in the blood.
Yeah. And your career, your profession up to this, a police officer and firefighter.
Yeah. licensed as a police officer, firefighter, EMT, instructor credentials in all three.
And so born and raised in the Big Rapids area?
Mecosta County, the east side of Mecosta County. I'm fifth generation Mecosta County resident.
Wow. So you've seen quite a bit in this area then.
Yeah, good and a bad.
You know, one of the things that we hear about this area, not being from it, we don't know for sure from talking with folks, but as far as poverty, there is a little bit of it up there.
Yeah, we're one of the poorest counties in the Lower Peninsula. The poorest being Lake County at 19.4%. Mecosta County's at 19.1%. So yeah, there's a problem there.
What do you think is the problem? Where do you think that comes from?
A lot of it is lack of jobs. With the auto industry, their contraction a number of years ago, we lost such things as Everett Products. We lost some other opportunities within the Big Rapids, close community itself, and the ability to bring companies up here, large companies, and provide them what they need is difficult. It's a lot of them will head for Southern Michigan, Southeast Michigan, not so much up here.
What about like tourism or anything like that?
Tourism is here. Absolutely. We've got, quite honestly, one of the best county park systems in the state of Michigan, have had for decades. We've got some beautiful areas. We're now adding that the Dragon Head Trail, you may have heard of, walking, biking trail and across two counties. That is definitely a source of income, but it's a seasonal source. And it doesn't necessarily provide the number of good paying jobs that are needed to sustain a community.
So I think that kind of brings us to the biggest part of this conversation is Goshen Inc., which recently the Senate Appropriations Committee approved giving them, you know, basically the green light for a state-funded incentive. What is the community on the ground perspective on this plant?
The community is split. There is no question about that. There is a small but very vocal group that are trying to tie this international company to Chinese communism and use that as a handle to fight it. There is a large, very large contingent of our community that recognizes the economic opportunity this provides, not only the plant itself, but the offshoot growth, the non-direct or indirect jobs, all of that. And then there's those in the middle that are trying to sort out fact from fiction.
So how did this come about? How did you first hear about this and get involved? How long has this been in the pipeline?
In the pipeline, last summer, they came to me. They had originally, the company had looked at an industrial park in our neighboring township to the south. It butts right up against our township. When that was developed 20 years ago, there was an area in our township that was also then designated for industrial growth. It was designed to share utilities between the two townships and so on. But the way the economic growth and the tides went, nothing happened. That land is set unused for 20 years. The Goshen came to the industrial park looking to be able to get the whole industrial park. That wasn't enough space. Then they came to Green Township to see if they could add some land to the project. Things developed from there, some good, some bad. They were going to come, they weren't going to come. We didn't have rail, so that took us off the table. But then some other places had some other negatives that they were willing to compromise on the rail issue and come back here. They looked at Big Rapids Township, but then they found out it's at the end of the municipal runway, so they can't build a building taller than 20 foot per FAA. Now, will that work? No, it won't. Let's take everything north. And the end result is their entire project is now located in that industrial park or industrial area within Green Township.
So, you know, how long would you say that you were having these kind of back and forth conversations with Goshen?
4 to 6 months probably before things worked out to the point where it was made public, and we started talking between all the entities about setting up a Renaissance Zone, public meetings, giving people opportunity to review it, small group meetings ahead of time with different community leaders, explaining what was going on, giving them a chance to ask questions. It's been quite a long, detailed process.
So it seems that Goshen themselves have come and had a conversation with you. But how often have you talked to the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, the ones responsible for the state incentives?
The MEDC, myself, not that much. The MEDC is working with a economic nonprofit group out of Grand Rapids called The Right Place. The supervisor of Big Rapids Township called them in to help him when Goshen first came to him. And then we worked from there. They've done a lot more working with MEDC than I have directly, other than maybe a Zoom call where both of us were on at the same time.
Now, there was a pretty large stretch of time there where you had a non-disclosure agreement. You weren't allowed to talk about it. That's been a source of some controversy. People are claiming it's a secret deal and so forth. What's been your response to that?
Well, first, let me clear something up. I have never signed an NDA. Okay. I've never been asked to sign an NDA. Honest truth, when people started yelling about an NDA, I had to Google it to see what the devil it was. I'm sorry, small rural township, not necessarily my normal forte. I understand that maybe the MEDC uses them. I know a lot of businesses, when they start doing research, they have to do it. Can you imagine how much any company stock would go up and down and up and down every time every rumor came through? And so they use NDAs. It's common business practice. I myself haven't. When they came to me, they said, Jim, this is what we're looking at. We kind of like to keep it quiet while we see if the details really work out. We're not even sure we're going to get this. We're one of a number of places being looked at. And so I was asked to, you know, not make a big noise about it. And I agreed.
And that's all it took, right? You didn't have to sign anything.
Well, I'm not very good at doing my job. My word doesn't mean anything. So
there you go. There you go. So what's kind of the process now? We had a Senate vote. Senate Appropriations has agreed to this money from our SOAR fund, the Strategic Outreach, and this retention fund. Where do we go from here?
As I understand it, MEDC reached out to The Right Place, asked them to administrate the grants. So those grants, will be available through the Right Place for reimbursement. It's strictly reimbursement grants, 100% grants, but reimbursement. The infrastructure grant includes, for instance, $1.1 million to my township for some sewer repairs that are necessary. We'll have to, say, hire the engineering company. They come in, they do the design, they submit a bill, we pay the bill, we submit that under a sub-grant system, then to The Right Place, get our money back after we paid the engineering company. The same thing with land purchases, or the road commission has two roads they have to do some major upgrades to. MDOT has some work on the business route and on the freeway to do. All that stuff goes through in that manner.
Is there any way for local governments to stop this from happening?
Green Township does not have an on-off switch. There is not a switch I can hit to stop this if I chose to. It's kind of like, example probably is not a good one, but the simple fact is it's a matter of guiding things where they're coming. So we ask them to consider our needs in that sewer system, and they agree. We talk to them about wanting to make sure that there's sufficient parking on site to get this, any backup and semis off the roadway. And we're negotiating on that. It's kind of a goodwill type thing. We're asking them to consider some help to our fire departments for the to help cover the extra responsibility those fire departments are taking on. And they're willing to discuss that.
What about like a referendum or something like that? Is there a petition or something local people can get together, sign and put on the ballot and say, we want these people to go away?
Well, that has been a question because the original discussion of a referendum was when Big Rapids Township was part of it. The industrial park there was property of Big Rapids Township. And so do they or do they not sell? That can be a public referendum. For us, it's 32 separate private landowners. There is not going, cannot be a referendum on whether or not we allow person A to sell to person B. I mean, that sounds a little bit more like communism than a democracy. So there's really not a binding issue to have a referendum on.
Like a zoning? What about zoning or anything like
that? The county handles zoning in our county. Our township is too small to have its own zoning department or building department. We may as this growth comes, but for right now it's handled by the county. And so there is has been an application submitted to county to rezone a couple of the pieces of property that are not in the industrial area. And there'll be a hearing on that and a decision by that board at that time.
Okay. But that could get challenged maybe at a referendum, but that would be at a county level though.
Yes, correct. That would be a county level. There are some clauses in the law that allow that, and that may be something that somebody wants to pursue to try and delay this or whatever, but we'll have to wait and see how that goes.
Jim, when you first ran for Green Township Supervisor, I'm quite sure you didn't expect what you've gotten these last several months. What are some of the crazier rumors that you've heard, these crazy small town rumors that you've heard as this whole Goshen plant has been coming down the pipe?
Let me see. I authorized a sewer pipe to be put directly from the plant to the Muskegon River to dump their raw sewage in. I authorized them to put in outdoor retention ponds to put dangerous chemicals setting outside, that they need the 80-foot tall cooling towers so they can hide ballistic missiles in it.
Wow, that's a lot of power you got.
Yeah, I tell you, social media is always interesting.
So if you personally had to bet, do you think Goshen is going anywhere?
You mean other than Mecosta County?
Exactly.
The possibility is there, no doubt about it. There are, you know, if a snag came up in the money, we knew that that Michigan had lost that. They've made it very plain that if they leave Big Rapids, they leave Michigan. And so there goes 2,350 jobs along with the other 5,000 indirect jobs. Is there something else? If they run into some snags or major issues on zoning, it's possible. We'll just have to see how that goes, but there's no guarantee that they're coming.
Would you put it a 75% chance that they're going to be here? 50% chance?
Probably between 80 and 90.
Okay. So it's still pretty good, but there's still a chance.
Yeah, it's pretty good, but no guarantees.
You know, I think one thing that I've just gotten a bit curious on throughout covering all of this, you know, could you ever imagine someone from Goshen saying, you know what, maybe Michigan is not worth the political headache, just given, you know, the loud groups that have come forward with the opposition toward this?
Well, your last guest talked about hyperpolarization in politics, and that's a very accurate statement. There's been a number of times when we saw this small but vocal group trying to twist things to make everybody look like the devil incarnate that I half expected Goshen to say, a curse on both your houses and walk away. It hasn't happened, and I appreciate it, but it always could.
Well, I can certainly see how that could happen, but it looks like everything's going in a direction that would happen where Goshen is going to establish this plant here in your township. And we appreciate you talking with us. Jim Chapman, he is the supervisor from Green Township in Mecosta County. Appreciate you briefing us here on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you for your time.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to all of our guests this week, Liz Smith, Senator Jeff Irwin, and Jim Chapman, the supervisor in Green Township. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos. Thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. For Samantha Schreiber, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.